From the Sky News Centre at 6, the UK is unlikely to have a general election in October after opposition parties agreed to work together to block Boris Johnson's plan. They say they want to prevent the UK leaving the EU without a deal next month, but the Prime Minister says they're scared.
They don't trust the people, they don't want an election. OK. Perhaps it is that they don't think that they will win. Fine. I'll go to Brussels, I'll get a deal, and we'll make sure we come out on October the 31st. That's what we've got to do.
A bill which aims to prevent a no-deal Brexit will become law on Monday after being approved in the House of Lords earlier. Meanwhile, it's emerged Boris Johnson described former Prime Minister David Cameron as a girly swat in a handwritten note shown in court. The comment was hidden in the case about suspending Parliament, but an unredacted version has been leaked. The British government says many people will have mixed emotions about the death of Robert Mugabe, aged 95. He was president of Zimbabwe for 37 years and seen by some as a liberator, but also faced accusations of human rights abuses and corruption. Residents in the worst-hit parts of the Bahamas are being offered free air evacuations by the government there after Hurricane Dorian caused widespread devastation. At least 30 people have died in the country. And several pupils have been banned from lessons for not having a new gender-neutral uniform, which prevents girls from wearing skirts. Some parents at the school in East Sussex say they can't afford the new clothes. That's the latest. I'm Kit Bradshaw.
We would like to thank our listeners and organisations across the city for the heartwarming outpouring of love and support shown to us during this difficult time. Not only have you told us how much we mean to you, but you've also contributed in excess of £12,000 to help us rebuild our studio and station facilities.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is our local Brexit Party candidate for South West England, Anne Tarr. Former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers are here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Mike Pence and Netanyahu arrive to lobby Boris on his first week in the Commons. The US State Department is offering millions of dollars in bribes, $50 million apparently, to the captain of the Iranian oil tanker, the Grace One, which has now been renamed the Adrian Daria, in Gibraltar. The bribe was to sail her to a friendly US port so that she could be impounded. He turned it down. And has Hong Kong come back from the brink, a real test for the demonstrators, as Carrie Lam withdraws the China extradition bill permanently, in an enormous climb down by Beijing. And Epstein, more on him with an expert on Zionist organised crime and the UK angle, who is Nicole Junkerman. Apart from being Epstein's friend running IT in the National Health Service, who is she? And carried over from last week, Norman Dodd, on how our entire education system, from primary to universities, has been subverted to the agenda of the financial oligarchy. That is, foundation funding. The new world order that isn't supposed to exist. That's all in the second hour, after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius and sunny spells. Next week, highs around 18, heavy rain on Monday, some sunshine and light rain the rest of the week, though. Next weekend, the 14th and 15th of September, highs around 17 Celsius, mostly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is our local Brexit Party candidate for South West England, Anne Tarr. Anne, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Great to be back. I am now actually a named prospective parliamentary candidate.
For Parliament? For
Parliament.
Which seat?
For North Somerset. So that's Clevedon, Portishead and Ailsa, with Liam Fox as a sitting MP.
Not standing against Jacob Rees-Mogg, then?
No, it's not my local area.
So who is standing against him for the Brexit Party? Do we know?
I don't know who that is. I'm not sure they've been announced as yet.
So what do you make of this week in politics, first of all? It's been quite interesting, hasn't it, seeing parliamentarians arrive, and also, I suppose, the first clash between Boris and Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, in the House of Commons, head-to-head. What do you make of the shenanigans? Because what we've had is various things. Most importantly, the threat of a general election to sort all this out being refused by the Labour Party and by the Lib Dems.
Yeah, there's been so much going on this week. I think we could probably take your 2 hours here, Tony, just talking about the week. But I think I think if you look at it from a public perspective, what we've seen are MPs acting in a way that's completely unacceptable. Because the way that the democracy works in this country is that we elect MPs to Parliament. They elect the main party in the House forms the executive, and the executive puts forward legislation. And that's just been shot to pieces this week. We've seen MPs thinking that they are the boss and they can decide what happens.
They've got to decide to do what they think's best, haven't they? And that's absolutely understood in our Constitution.
That's a misinterpretation of the Constitution. Parliament is sovereign. It's not.
What about the Queen? The Queen is the surely. Hang on, because we could get bogged down here, couldn't we? The Queen is sovereign. The people are sovereign.
No, she's sure.
I mean, democracy means the people are sovereign. The Queen is the sovereign, but
no.
Actually, Parliament's sovereign. This is could get quite confusing.
Tony, in our system, the system isn't terribly logical, but the way it works is the Crown shares sovereignty with Parliament, but Parliament is sovereign. It's not the government. This is really important.
This anti-no-deal Brexit bill that's passed, though, it actually has depended, hasn't it, Kevin, on the Speaker to allow this to happen. For this to take place, the Speaker has had to allow it. And it means changing standing orders in Parliament, which is not really regular, but anyway, and a change to the Queen's speech, too. So, specific individuals, people like the Leader of the House, the Queen, Jacob Rees-Mogg, their opinion is going to determine whether they decide we're going to tweak the rules a little bit here, doesn't it?
Well, that's one of the issues. The rules are tweakable. They're flexible. It's an unwritten constitution. But the key thing is Rees-Mogg and his two chums went to see the Queen with a new arrangement for the parliamentary calendar. The person they didn't take with them, or tell, was the Speaker. That is a huge breach of the conventions.
Okay, so lots of conventions being breached.
Well, everywhere.
Definitely everywhere. Let's see how far we can bend the rules. But let's have a listen now to the backdrop to all of this, which is, as Martin Summers, probably, how long is it, Martin? Probably 11 years you've been banging on here about the potential financial crisis. I picked up what I thought was a fascinating interview today, earlier this morning, by a guy called Donald Anstad. He's an investor for Aberdeen Standard Investments, and he says, actually, the Western financial system is shot. We have now decided at my company we're moving all of our money out of the West. We're moving it to Singapore. And let's have a listen. This is a little clip from it, and I'll put a link up to the full thing on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And this is a little clip from Donald Anstad now.
The only people who've made money in the last 10 years are the 1% of the 1%, the elite who hold equities. And, of course, we have this huge bubble in the stock market, and 99.9% of the population have been left behind. If you think about traditional portfolio theory, what has been the role of government bonds been in portfolios? It's been the asset class that makes money when risky assets fall off. In 1998, when equities fell, if you had bonds, you did really well because bond prices went up and equities went down. If you did your portfolio rebalancing and sold out of your bonds and bought equities, and if you did that in every bump along the road over the last 20 or 30 years, you've done well. But it's always been, every crisis we've had has always been about a bubble bursting in 1998 in emerging markets. In 2007, it was credit markets. In 1987, it was the stock market. In 2000, it was in tech. What we've never had to cope with before is when there is a bubble in the risk-free asset class. What happens when that goes pop? What's the new risk-free? In an environment where the West finally wakes up and takes the medicine, it's going to impact everybody, including emerging markets. So emerging markets will not be immune. But I think in that type of environment, relatively, emerging markets will do better. And emerging markets will do better because they will be able to respond more proactively. And they are able to do that because, frankly, emerging market balance sheets are far stronger than the balance sheets of the developed world.
Well, that's a pretty solid analysis, I have to say. I think you've got to look at Russia, for example. They've got hardly any debt at all. They've got no debt at all. They were in debt, but they've managed to clear it all.
Yeah, they're paying proper interest, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
The West, for example, Switzerland.
Well, the Chinese economy is a bit of a conundrum because it's obviously a very strong economy, but they've got an awful lot of debt. But both countries have a very proactive policy. They don't believe in free markets as such. And of course, the West has actually, the West's free market philosophy has basically vaporized itself through, you know, its internal contradictions.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it? That places like Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa may be the new, in 10 years' time, they could be where all the economic growth is happening, and we could be a kind of third world here.
Well, I think it's inevitable in the long run that poorer countries are going to catch up with rich countries. I mean, that's the theory of market economics, you know. The idea, if we all trade together, then ultimately that's good for everybody, and that includes, you know, poorer countries doing better, relatively speaking. We don't want them to be poor forever, do we? And, of course, the richer they get, the more we can sell things to them. So it's a win-win situation. It's not a question of one side winning and the other side losing, but of course it's become a win-lose situation because of the hegemonic policies of the Anglo-Zionist, you know, bloc. They're not prepared to share and cooperate with other forces. I mean, they want to keep the power they've had for the last 500 years.
Isn't QE a big part of this, actually?
Of course, well, QE was supposed to be going on for a few months while the market stabilised.
We used to call it printing money. In fact, one of the things he said in his talk, and another point, is that we've been telling everybody, don't print money, you'll get runaway inflation. But now we're doing it like it's going out of fashion anyway. And I know you've had a bit of experience as doing investments and that sort of thing. I wonder what you make of that, because what he's saying, Donald Anstatt, there is that what used to be safe bets, these government bonds, could actually be incredibly fragile and go down. So, and he's asking the question, not me, he's asking the question, where is the new safe bet? And he doesn't have an answer, apart from, you know, maybe in places like Singapore, etc.
Well, I'm not going to admit to being an absolute expert on this, but what I would say is the levels of government debt are frightening. And you look at what's going to happen to the euro with the Italian banks, and it's not a question necessarily of Italy being allowed to leave the eurozone when the eurozone are going to kick Italy out, because that's going to be unsustainable.
Well,
and what is going to happen
is,
in that situation?
People like Mario Draghi being replaced, who is it, by Christine Lagarde, I think, soon. What they do is they just make sure, if a bank looks a bit shaky, they just shove a load of money at it and make sure it lives to fight another day.
Well, they can't carry on doing that. They're running out of wriggle room. And what's going to happen when sooner or later, the chickens will come home to roost. We know that. You can't carry on just borrowing your way out of trouble. Sooner or later, there has to be a reckoning. Something will happen.
I mean, Kevin, surely the Americans have been doing this since the 1970s. Borrow, borrow, borrow all the time.
The key thing is, you've raised it, printing money. Normally, that leads to inflation, but we haven't got it. So the banks and all the institutions have realised that printing money doesn't necessarily lead to inflation, so they've carried on doing the bad thing, printing money, doing exactly what you said. Bad bank, throw money at it.
Can I just make a comment? There has been inflation, asset price inflation. That's not included in consumer inflation, but in actual fact, the values in the stock markets are absolutely completely out of line with the price to earnings ratio is ridiculously out of line, and it keeps, and of course it looks a way to make money, and you can carry on making money until it crashes.
So these shares are at a certain value because they are making money, and there's a dividend, there's returns on them, etc. But that doesn't actually bear much relation to the real value of the business. companies.
Well, what's actually happening is people are making money from the shares going up in value, not the dividends. The dividends are some of these tech startups haven't made a profit in years, but their shares carry on rising because it's a rising market. Basically, it's rising on all the funny money that's been created.
The fundamental here,
which you shouldn't do. I mean, the textbook says you shouldn't do that. People are threw the textbook out the window years ago.
People are buying shares because the share value is increasing, not because the company is sound.
That's right. And in actual fact, all values increase simultaneously, and it's a one-way bet to make money if you're on the inside. In other words, what happened is when the government stepped in to bail out the financial sector, the taxpayer was put on the hook for propping up the financial oligarchy. And that of course, that's a one-way bet for them. As Milton Friedman pointed out years ago, if you bail out failing industries, whether it's a car industry, a steel industry, or a financial services industry, it's not a one-off. They keep coming back for more. And of course, it's basically they've captured the politics. The government debt that Anne mentioned earlier is virtually all the socialisation of private debts, which should have been allowed to be got rid of. But that would have crashed the stock market and wiped out loads of people. Like Jacob Rees-Mogg would have to go down to get his P45, and they weren't going to do that.
This is the banking. People on all sides of the Brexit debate have money in that little game. But let's have a listen now to this week's strange shenanigans of the return of Parliament. And to start with, on Monday, Boris is calling for a general election.
Even if we don't, we will leave anyway on October the 31st. The people of this country will have to choose, Mr. Speaker. The Leader of the Opposition has been begging for an election for 2 years. He has crowds of supporters outside calling for an election. I don't want an election, but if MPs vote tomorrow to stop negotiations and to compel another pointless delay to Brexit, potentially for years, then that would be the only way to resolve this. And I can confirm that we are tonight tabling a motion under the Fixed Term Parliament Act. Thank you.
Point of order, Jeremy Corbyn. Mr. Speaker, on a point of order, I welcome tonight's vote. We live in a parliamentary democracy. We do not have a presidency, but a prime minister. Prime ministers govern with the consent of the House of Commons, representing the people in whom the sovereignty rests. There is no consent. There is no consent in this House to leave the European Union without a deal. There is no majority for no deal in the country.
So, Kevin, what Boris is saying there, I suppose, is let's just have a general election. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't want it, though. He's been calling for a general election, as Boris points out, for 2 years. Suddenly now changed his mind.
That's just total diversion.
Why has he changed his mind? I mean, a general election might help sort this out, mightn't it?
Anybody who is in power, you know, the leader of the opposition, the government and so on, they want to choose an election at the best moment for them.
Don't they just want to delay Brexit? Isn't that really what this is about?
No. They
want Brexit, do they?
Jeremy Corbyn, fundamentally, I think, is a Brexiteer. His line of politics...
He certainly was.
Yeah,
he's not anymore.
He was not a Remainer. His particular corner of the political world was always anti-EU.
Anyway, Martin, isn't what's really happened here is that this referendum is extremely inconvenient. Actually, things were going on as normal. Suddenly a referendum's come along and Parliament just can't cope with it.
Well, go on, now, finish. I was just going to say, obviously referendums are not really a part of the British system. Nope. So if you have one...
Well, we had a referendum to go into at the
end. Of course, the thing is that David Cameron called it thinking it was a slam dunk. And of course it didn't turn out that way. And of course then you've got the problem of a parliament having to implement it when they don't actually necessarily agree with it and they don't really know what they're doing. And it was always going to be like this because it's quite... It's quite tricky because you've got different sources of political authority coming from referendums, coming from general elections. Theresa May hadn't called the election in 2017, we'd be in a completely different position because she didn't basically win it.
Do you think the Queen should step in and say, come on, bang heads together?
Well, can I just dial back a bit? The real issue here is the fact that 498 MPs voted to pass Article 50, leading us out of the EU. If they had no intention of leaving without a deal, that is the moment they should have said, you know what, we need to see what the deal is before we vote for this. And that, I think, was Theresa May's biggest mistake, because she set the clock ticking. And you know, in a negotiation, once the clock starts ticking, then you're up against it, because something has happened. You end up between a rock and a hard place, which is where Theresa May found herself. And that is precisely and totally the fault of our MPs, our current MPs, because they should not have passed that if they didn't mean to do it. And you can't then pass that by that whacking great majority and then say 2 years later, actually, guys, we made a mistake. We wish we hadn't done it. But what do we do? Because we've promised the electorate.
Anyway, that was Monday. Now on to Tuesday. And this whole bill, the anti-no deal Brexit bill, is being discussed. This amazing backbench bill. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, leader of the House now, was questioned on it and gave way in an intervention to Oliver Letwin, the Conservative MP, but on both on completely opposite sides of the fence here. He's one of those who have now been kicked out of the Conservative Party, certainly won't be standing at the next election if Boris Johnson gets his way, and that's a big if, of course.
I'm very grateful to my right honourable friend for giving way. I understand his views and his concerns about the supposed constitutional irregularity of these proceedings, and no doubt in the future all these things can be debated. Will he accept that we stand as a nation at present at a moment which will have a profound effect on the welfare of our people, and that the sovereign parliament of this country clearly deserves an opportunity to be able to decide whether it will accept a policy of no deal exit or not, and that that overwhelmingly matters more than whether the Standing Order 24B clause with where in it, misdrafted in all probability by the then Leader of the House, has a particular meaning or does not have a particular meaning.
There is, Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry to say, a stunning arrogance to that view. And it fails to understand where sovereignty comes from. So I do indeed dare to say this, and I say that to the right honourable gentleman.
Order. I recognise that there are strongly held views on both sides of the House on all aspects of this matter, but the Leader of the House must be heard. The Leader.
Mr. Speaker, sovereignty in this House comes from the British people, and the idea that we can overrule 17.4 million people is preposterous, and the idea that our rules do not exist to protect the people from arrogant power grabs is mistaken. Those rules are there for the protection of the people. I have given way so many times and to many distinguished members, and it is now time to come on to this motion, which is extraordinary and unprecedented. Parliament is attempting to set aside Standing Order number 14 to give precedence to the EU Withdrawal number 6 bill. This motion goes further and seeks to claim an unknown and unquantified number of subsequent days for consideration of Lords' amendments and messages. It is a fundamental principle that government is able to transact its business in this House, a principle this House has long accepted in Standing Order number 14. This motion also sets aside, in a new parliamentary session, the standing orders that apply in relation to the presentation of private members' bills. The motion would allow a designated member, few of the Illuminati who are taking the powers to themselves, to give notice of presentation of this bill on the first day of the new session, and then provide time for debate on this bill on the second day of the new session, interrupting the Queen's speech. There is an established process for the House debating the Queen's speech, a process that this bill would undermine. While the Outlawries Bill has its first reading just before the start of the Queen's Speech debate, this bill is only read a first time as a formality and not debated. To interrupt the Queen's speech to debate a backbench bill such as the one proposed in this motion would be unprecedented.
So here we go again. More arguments about sovereignty. At the end of the day, though, and I'll ask you again, do you think that maybe the Queen needs to intervene here and say, look, we're in this insane situation where a general election is being blocked by the opposition party, been calling for it for such a long time, and that is really one of the only ways we're going to get over this hump?
Well, I think if you look at the length of time the Queen's been on the throne, it would be completely unprecedented for her to intervene in this way, and it would be a very unwelcome intervention. This is where MPs need to step up to the plate, accept their responsibilities and start acting reasonably instead of the way they're behaving at the moment.
I think there are two key issues. The British Constitution, unwritten though it is, actually has no place for referenda. They are always anomalies.
So we shouldn't have had that referendum?
In theory, if you follow the old, you know, the supposed constitution, you don't do referendums. Parliament decides and that's the end of the story. That's how it's supposed to work.
I mean, doesn't Parliament make these decisions and then the government, the executive, go off and do the negotiations? Because what's happening here is Parliament is saying, no, we're doing the negotiations now.
Well, this is Parliament asserting the sovereignty that is genuinely in the Constitution.
But why did Parliament allow the Referendum Act to pass? Because they had to pass it.
Anna, it's not the only one. Every time there's been a referendum, how many have we had? Three or four? The constitutional experts have always mumbled about it and said, you know, this is just confirmatory.
Say, for example, if we're going to change the voting system, there was the idea that we should have a referendum on that. We had a referendum on it, about 8 years ago or so, and the people voted, no, we don't want this.
Yeah.
So should Parliament just, these sorts of things, Martin, just be left to Parliament?
Well, I think the fact is that the legal position, as I understand, is that Parliament is sovereign. There's a political pressure on people to fulfil the referendum, but there's no legal pressure on them to do so. And if the parliamentary members of Parliament change their minds and decide that they want to extend Article 50 or get rid of Article 50, the legal position is that they can. Now, that will upset some people who are opposed to that, but the fact is that's the legal position as far as I understand it.
I mean, it would be nice to think the people were sovereign, but we're not.
No, this is an oligarchy. We've never had sovereignty of the people in this country. When did we ever have it?
Well, not according to Jacob Rees-Mogg. Let's have a listen to him again.
There is a routine constitutional procedure to deal with that, and that is the vote of confidence. And yes, we are a representative body, but where does our sovereignty come from? And here I'm in agreement with the Scots. Sovereignty comes from the people to Parliament. We hold it in trust for them, and they gave us an instruction. And if we follow this route, we are left with but three options. We then have to accept the deal with its anti-democratic backstop. Yes. We have to keep on extending because Parliament would never accept that we are ready to leave, or we could simply revoke and tell 17.4 million people that they were wrong. The approach taken today is the most unconstitutional use of this House since the days of Charles Stuart Parnell when he tried to bung up Parliament. Usurping the executive's right is unconstitutional. The abuse of emergency debates to do so is unconstitutional. And the bill itself is yet more unconstitutional. A.V. Dicey said all conventions have one ultimate object, to secure that Parliament or the Cabinet shall in the long run give effect to the will of the people. These conventions are being disregarded today. And so, by extension, is the will of the nation. Parliament sets itself against the people. Sovereignty comes from the people to Parliament. It does not come to Parliament out of a void. If Parliament tries to challenge the people, this stretches the elastic of our Constitution near to breaking point. We should recognise that the people are our masters and show us to be their lieges and servants, not to place ourselves in the position of their overlords. As we come to vote today, I hope all members, Mr. Speaker, will contemplate the current constitutional confusion and consider the chaos this concatenation of circumstances could create.
The There's there are two anomalies. The first is how the will of the people is expressed. And in the British Constitution, it's not normally expressed in a referendum. It's expressed in an election.
But it is this time.
Yeah. And the second thing is that Rees-Mogg keeps wittering on about 17 million people. What about the other 16 million? Are they to be wiped off the map, driven out of Britain?
No, they don't, no one's going to drive them out of Britain, no, are they? It's just about, it is about making decisions, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
How do you make a decision? And it's actually been given to the people to make this decision, not Parliament, the people. Anyway, Martin.
Well, I think it's quite clear in the rules are that referenda in our system, because we don't have a written constitution, are advisory. That's the reality. I think I take Anne's point earlier that the MPs voted to trigger Article 50 after the referendum, but that's because they chose to do it, and they can change their minds and decide not to do it or to cancel it altogether. Now, ultimately, what we're talking about now is when, as I said earlier, and I'll be very brief. Theresa May called a general election. She basically lost, which is why she depended on the DUP, which is why you've got a backstop. That would not have happened if she'd carried on as she was, but she didn't, and therefore she lost that. That's the most recent test of national opinion.
I mean, isn't this whole thing just an attempt to delay Brexit? Delay.
Well, from the Liberal Democrats' point of view, it's an attempt to stop it altogether, as they're absolutely entitled to do if they don't agree with it.
So what about Labour's point of view?
Well, Labour's point of view, they're trying to keep a coalition together of people who are Remainers and some of the people who are... Some Labour Party people voted with the government against this bill.
We had the absurd thing on Question Time last night of Emily Thornberry saying, well, we were going to do a deal if Labour gets... Jeremy Corbyn's in charge, we will do a deal, the Labour government will do a deal, but I will campaign against it. I'll campaign for Remain.
I think the fact is, what I would say is, if we do have a referendum, and I think there's going to be a general election and a referendum, people will just have to vote which way they believe is the right thing to do, and everybody should... we need to take the debate down a bit, because everybody's got different views, and that's just got to be accepted.
It's interesting to hear the talk about all referenda are advisory, because that wasn't the message that was given when we were having the debate and we had the vote in 2016.
Well, it wasn't written on the paper,
it
either.
It wasn't written on the paper, no.
Well, that's because he couldn't promise it.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But talking to the ordinary person in the street, they heard David Cameron say that what would happen is that we would trigger Article 50, there'd be the two-year negotiating period with the EU. If we couldn't arrange a free trade deal, then we would leave and we would trade on WTO terms, which is a recognised way of trading in these situations.
It wasn't just, by the way, David Cameron. It was the whole political class, including Letwin and various other people, saying we will leave. This is an in or out referendum. There was no talk of a deal at that stage whatsoever.
Or advisory.
No talk of WTO rules either.
No,
himself said that if anybody says that we're leaving the single market by voting to leave the EU, they're scaremongering. That's on the record. So people didn't know. We didn't talk about WTO rules or the single market at all. The Norway option was definitely on the table, where we leave the EU but we stay in the single market. And that was definitely the case. Loads of people I know voted leave.
Martin, okay, you made your point and reply.
Martin, yeah. I would just say that David Cameron did talk about trading on WTO rules. He said in a TV interview, one of the TV debates, I think it was with Sky, where he said that is what the situation would be. If we left, we would trade on WTO rules. My understanding is that the EU offered us a free trade agreement if Theresa May wanted to negotiate it, and she turned it down. So I think the EU would have given us a free trade deal if we'd gone and asked for it, but she never did.
Finally, on Brexit, if we can move a little bit away from this now, because it's the extraordinary situation we're in now, where the government may be tabling a motion of no confidence in themselves. Anne, this is bizarre, isn't it?
I find it completely idiotic. I just find it bonkers, and I think the people on the street just think it, and that's what I was saying at the beginning, Tony. You know, you're just looking at the events in Parliament this week, shaking your head, thinking, what on earth is going on?
It's not totally bonkers, is it? Because it wouldn't have happened before the Fixed Term Parliament Act. We would have had a general election announced this week.
Well, it just goes to show what an appalling piece of legislation that was. Thank you, the Liberal Democrats, because you insisted on that. We should never have got rid of it. And this is where the conventions that we operated under are best sometimes left unwritten and not being forced into things like the Fixed Term Parliament
Act. Desperately to find a bit of common ground, actually. Martin, you've said similar things about the Fixed Term Parliament Act on this show in the past, haven't you?
Well, I'm in favour of proportional representation, so that the Brexit Party could put its case, everybody could hear what you got to say what we've got to say, and votes wouldn't be wasted. The real tragedy of a general election is because it's going to be fought under first past the post. Whoever loses is going to cry foul because of the way the votes are counted. And of course, in Ireland, that was got rid of in 1920. But that
anyway,
wasn't
Kevin,
an entirely
what do you
process.
Make of this threat by the government to call a no confidence motion in themselves and trigger an election?
It's because they've run out of procedural options. It's an admission of total failure.
I mean, is this fixed-term parliament act, surely? I mean, it's slightly absurd, isn't it, that the Prime Minister wants an election and he can't have one?
Well, the absurdities, like I said, arise from the failure to fix the referendum properly in the rules. But the second thing, I am an emigrant, of course. I came to this country 50 years ago, and I have great faith in the British electorate to be pragmatic. And I think the lack of pragmatism was the failure to make some kind of gesture to those who wanted to remain.
Isn't there another side to this? And that is that this is a deliberate attempt to discredit the whole democratic system, as we've seen in many other parts of the world. The big corporations, the banks, are actually looking at the parliament and rubbing their hands and saying, what a bunch of fools.
Well, people like Rees-Mogg are all making money out of the ups and downs of the pound. And you know, every time the pound shifts, a bunch of these people who are financing the flaming thing make piles of money.
I mean, it's one of the most hilarious things when you hear about Jeremy Corbyn talking about a banker's Brexit, because the banks obviously hate the idea of Brexit. They love being able to lobby just one place in Brussels and Strasbourg. They don't want us to leave the EU. It'll make life much harder for them. They want us subjected and kept in this nice little entity under their rule.
Well, I think there are some that were lobbying both ways there, actually. But anyway, let's go to Prime Minister's questions now and have a listen to Boris and Jeremy, their first little locking of horns this week.
You don't have to go very far from the portals of this House to see real destitution. People begging and sleeping on the streets. Child poverty is up since 2010. Pensioner poverty is up. In-work poverty is up. And he won't give us any of the information of the assessments of increased poverty that could come from his government's proposals. We are less than 60 days away from leaving the EU with no deal. The Prime Minister has had 2 days in office before the summer recess and then planned to prorogue Parliament. Yesterday he lost one vote, his first vote in Parliament. He now wants to dissolve Parliament. He's desperate, absolutely desperate, to avoid scrutiny. In his third day in office, after 5 questions from me, we haven't had an answer to any of them. I can see why he's desperate to avoid scrutiny. He has no plan to get a new deal, no plan, no authority, and no majority. Mr. Speaker, if the Prime Minister does to the country what he's done to his party in the past 24 hours, I think a lot of people have a great deal to fear from his incompetence, his vacillation, and his refusal to publish known facts that are known to him about the effects of a no-deal Brexit.
Mr. Speaker, I really don't see how, with a straight face, the Right Honourable Gentleman can accuse anybody of being unwilling to stand up to scrutiny when he will not agree. He will not agree to submit his surrender bill to the verdict of the people in an election. He's frightened. And Mr. Speaker, he makes a contrast. He makes a contrast between this government and his own proposals. The contrast could not be clearer. We think that the friends of this country are to be found in Paris and in Berlin and in the White House, and he thinks that they're in the Kremlin and in Tehran and in Caracas. And I think he's Caracas, Mr. Speaker. We're putting 20,000 police on the street. We're upgrading 20. We have 20 new hospital upgrades. We are growing the economy. He, by contrast, would put a £300 billion tax on every company in the country. He wants a tax on homes, and he's calling incessantly for a general strike. The Shadow Education Secretary says that their economic policy is, and I quote, Mr. Speaker, by your leave, shit or bust. I say it's both. I say it's both, Mr. Speaker. What this country needs is sensible, moderate, progressive, conservative government, and to take this country out of the EU on October the 31st, and that is what we are going to deliver.
Well, the fundamental problem for Boris Johnson now is he's lost his majority. When you say the government should control the agenda in Parliament, well, he hasn't got a majority. And the Fixed Term Parliament Act means that what's going to happen now is either he's going to lose this vote on Monday, clearly.
If he hasn't got a majority, as you say, surely the thing to do is to go to the Queen.
What happens now in the Fixed Term Parliament, there's then 25 days in which the other parties can try and form an alternative government. Now, if we're prorogued all the way through the summer, that means that will definitely take us beyond the 31st. But of course, he will still be the Prime Minister unless he resigns, and he will have to go to Brussels to ask for an extension. He's already said he will resign rather than do that, and he may have to call a vote of no confidence in himself. In order to, and of course, then puts the opposition parties in a position where they've got to vote for that, or just the real problem is that they could choose not to vote for it, and he stays the Prime Minister, and he has to go to Brussels to get an extension. The Brexit Party need to form an alliance. Basically, I shouldn't be telling you this, but the Brexit Party and the Tories need to form an alliance. But if he goes to Brussels and gets an extension, Farage has already said we are going to therefore. We're going to stand against you. Now, of course, this is going to make the arithmetic in all these constituencies very complex.
Just put that straight to Anne. Do you think that there's any likelihood of some sort of electoral alliance or electoral pact between the Conservatives and you?
Well, Nigel Farage has made that offer, and he has said to he said to Boris, "We can be your biggest friend or your worst enemy," and so that offer is out there on the table, and it's up to Boris whether he decides to accept it or not.
Another aspect to all this, Kevin, is that we're losing everything. Brexit is just taking over, and it looks as if it's going to be going on and on and on into the new year and beyond. And much of the other things that Jeremy Corbyn's talking about, the poverty, the destitution on the steps of the House of Commons, is being ignored.
You know, people dying in the underpass outside the House of Commons. It's all the kind of good, ordinary things that should be done are just totally lost.
An amazing spending review. It just seemed like it's been done specifically to persuade the public, and particularly public servants, to think about voting Conservative this week. An extra £13.8 billion of spending. Martin, I suppose you're going to say they can't really afford this, can they?
Well, it's they could have afforded it all along, but it's very interesting that when they've got their pet projects on the go, then there's some money's no object. There's not just a magic money tree, there's a whole forest of magic money trees. Now, that doesn't mean that in actual fact you could do this, but they're actually extending the budget deficit, which is actually, if we're going to have a recession, is actually a sensible thing to do. I mean, as somebody who's trained in macroeconomics, you don't, in fact, cut public expenditure when you're in a recession. You can't cut your way out of a crash.
But there's some pretty impressive decisions here. 2.6 billion rise in the school's budget this year, and 4.8 billion next year. A minimum per pupil amount of £5,000 for secondary schools. 700 million more for additional school funding on top of that. I mean, that's just schools. But this extends, Kevin, to the police. In fact, the whole of public spending is being increased, including defence and things like that.
But when all that money is spent, it'll still be a lot less than was taken from the schools, the police and everybody else in the last 8 years.
And what do you make of this massive increase in public spending? And Boris did a speech, didn't he, up with the police up north?
Yeah, well, Kevin is right. But even with this increase, we still have public spending will be below what it was in 2010. And the question is, we can't just respond this quickly. No organisation can respond this quickly to suddenly go and recruit all these extra police officers and so on. And the challenge is how do we make sure this money is spent wisely? And I think this whole aspect of public spending and how we invest in our infrastructure needs to be considered more carefully, because we have this approach where a minister will put his name to it and it all sounds wonderful, but then the proper costings haven't been done, the proper planning hasn't been done, and we're desperately in need of a better way of planning our infrastructure. This country is dying because of lack of infrastructure as much as anything else. The road system
so
is just
they're talking,
chaotic.
Sorry to interrupt you, but they're talking about stopping HS2, for example. That's infrastructure. Is that good or bad?
Well, there is an issue regarding the train network, but the issue is, do we really need to spend so much money on just one project, and how many people is it actually going to benefit? We're crying out for better links across the country, east to west. There are certain... I come from Portishead. I don't need to say anything about Portishead Railway. We keep banging on about the fact
that
we need it.
Yeah, you look like you might get one, actually. That's one of the few railways that might actually...
Yeah,
happen.
But we're having one service an hour, and it's going to take about 100 people, which isn't really going to make a big difference with the roads. But the road system is just chaotic, because there are so many cars on the road, and we don't have a system that means people can get around easily. And these are the hidden stresses that make people feel so stressed. And we talk about the stress levels outside of Westminster, forget about politics, but just the daily stress levels are so high because people can't get around this country because the infrastructure is so appalling.
Okay, well, one good bit of news, I suppose, is the 20,000 extra police that should replace those that have been lost since 2010. And here is a question about that, relating to that, at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Is Karen back?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As a result of budget cuts to the Home Office and largely enacted while he was Mayor of London, police numbers plummeted. 1,000 fewer officers in the West London Command Unit alone, one-third police officers down in my borough of Westminster. He is now promising us to get us back to where we were in 2010 with an additional 20,000. And he has told us, and he said again today, that those 20,000 will be frontline police and on the street. It is, however, now clear that at least 7,000 of those officers will not be frontline police. So in order to help this House build some trust in any of the promises he makes, can he tell us if that is true?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's absolutely bizarre that a Labour Member of Parliament for London should ignore the role of the present Mayor of London, who is frankly not a patch on the old guy, and I left him £600 million, by the way. I left him £600 million, and he squandered it on press officers. Sadiq Khan has squandered it on press officers, and the faster we get rid of Sadiq Khan and get more police officers out on the street, the better. And that's, in my view, the best possible argument for Sean Bailey as Mayor of London.
Yeah, so interesting. A lot of money's been going on communications here in Bristol too. Surely this, Martin, is quite good news that Sajid Javid, for example, you know, out of that nearly 14 billion, 1.5 billion boost for social care. I mean, is this just a bribe, or are they actually saying, well, you know, that really, you know, Theresa May talked about getting rid of austerity. We really are going to do it.
Well, as Kevin pointed out, the amount of money they're talking about is nothing. The amount of public spending that we had at the beginning of this process was far higher than what we've got now. So what has happened is we've just turned the corner. And of course, it's a welcome turn because it means that we can actually go back to policies as it used to be, where people vote to get stuff from the government, instead of the fantasy that if we keep cutting public expenditure, somehow the infrastructure will take care of itself because the market will do it. It doesn't work like that, as sensible people know.
Talking about infrastructure here in the southwest, bid to bring nuclear waste through Bridgewater to Hinkley has been rejected this week. We were talking last week about how Hinkley Seas looks like a white elephant, looking in many different ways. It probably won't happen ever. But the Bridgewater councillors were joined by Bridgewater and District Civic Society spokespeople and former town clerk Alan Herford to present a case to Somerset County Council allowing the move, which set a dangerous precedent to waste being brought to the Hinkley site. What they're proposing there, Kevin, was to actually bring spent nuclear fuel rods from all over the country to Hinkley Point, store them there.
Well, I mean, there's a huge problem with the nuclear. Look at the pictures of the 12 nuclear submarines that have been tied up in Plymouth for 15, 20 years, and nobody can find a solution. The nuclear waste is a terribly serious problem.
In a way, Martin, this is actually a physical coming of the nuclear waste problem to Hinkley, and the Somerset County Council have said no.
Well, the fundamental problem with nuclear power, I wrote a paper about this in the 1990s when they were talking about privatising it, and the City of London took one look at the books and said, you're joking. Because, of course, if you're made to look after the waste, then it's totally uneconomic. Yep. And the only way it's made to look economic is if the government, you know, the society, sorts out the waste for you. And of course, the French and others have bet the farm on it. I mean, more than half of their electricity is nuclear generated, and they don't know what to do with the waste. And the only thing they can do is sell on, like it's like pyramid selling or being a heroin addict. You've got to sell the stuff if you're going to keep running.
So they're basically saying, well, we control this site, and maybe we won't build this power station, but what we could do is build a great big hole and stick a whole load of nuclear waste in it instead.
Yeah, I think this whole issue about waste is really quite interesting, because it's not just nuclear that we have the problem with waste. We haven't worked out a way of how we're going to recycle solar panels, for example, and we've got those all over the country. And we also have the big, you know, the batteries now in cars for the electric vehicles. We have exactly the same issue there. So we're in this situation where we keep pushing ahead.
The solar powers don't stay radioactive for whatever it is, 40,000 years, do they?
No, there is a difference. But you have to remember, with nuclear waste, as I understand it, and I'm not a scientist, I'm not going to say I am, but my understanding is that at least with nuclear waste, it is very small and contained, unlike solar panels, which are much larger. And the likelihood is that we'll just export our waste problem with solar panels out to the, you know, out to the developing world, just as we have done our rubbish issues. So
Reversal, maybe the developed world will be sending their nuclear waste to us.
If we don't have nuclear power, how do we get carbon neutral?
Martin?
Well, I think ultimately, Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute wrote a paper in the 1990s again. This is the era when I worked for the New Economics Foundation.
This is about reducing our demand on energy.
Well, right? No, basically he said the answer to our problems is basically to become more efficient in the use of energy. Mm. Yeah? That's the answer.
That is.
No, we're not finding gimcrack solar panels, wind power, nuclear power.
We're just one example here, which is using fibre optics rather than 5G. 100 yeah. times or so less energy
that's
used.
Right.
We seem to be addicted to using energy, don't
well, that's
we?
The point. Don't forget, the energy companies sell energy. So ultimately they want to produce energy because that's what they sell. But if you had a comprehensive program of reducing energy use, yeah, design everything to be super, super efficient. And the technology, the beauty of that is the technology is already there. You've just got to say we want to do it and do it.
And we're always very happy to hear about how we must stop using cars so much and we must use more public transport and you save energy there. We don't talk about the increasing amount of energy that we spend globally on the internet, which is currently about 2% of all CO2 emissions. It's huge. And so what? How are we going to solve that? Nobody wants to have less internet use.
Martin, you said something about Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, Bitcoin mining was supposed to be, you know, it's just ethereal stuff. But in actual fact...
Just explain what it is.
Well, you know, these blockchain currencies, which have been developed outside the system... Although governments,
I understand it takes more and more computing power to create every new.
Yeah, you
Bitcoin.
Have to mine it. So, in other words, it's not like mining gold, where you actually get some gold at the end of it.
Where do you mine this stuff?
You have to use computer power to do it, and they've got computers whirring all day creating Bitcoin. You know, which is bonkers if you think about it, because it's not producing anything at all apart from using up your energy to create something which you can then use to.
Investing in this stuff, so you know more and more and more computer power is going to be swallowed up doing this.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with having an internet, but we don't actually have to be on the 24 hours a day. An hour a day is probably enough for everybody.
Anyway, coming down to earth a little bit more, we've heard about all these new police officers being recruited, but we've got Priti Patel as the new Home Secretary. She is paid £1,000 an hour to advise a US company which is bidding for a $6 billion defence contract. Patel worked as a strategic advisor to Viasat from the 1st of May to the 31st of July, earning £5,000 a month for an expected commitment of 5 hours a month. Well, that's the London Economic talking about that. The Home Secretary has been urged to withdraw from all cabinet discussions on this contract following the revelations. A lucrative £6 billion defence contract was revealed by The Guardian, Martin.
Well, it's the usual corruption, isn't it? I mean, in the US, all of these politicians who vote through these massive increases in military spending then end up on the boards of the companies which supply the weaponry. And it's disgusting, but it's, I mean, she's probably a small level player.
I mean, she was sacked, wasn't she? She's a bit of a Mandelson in the Tory party. She's one of those people that was found to be corrupt, sacked, and then has found her way back in again.
She wasn't found to be corrupt. What she was found to...
Well, she was lying about a trip to Israel.
Yeah, but that was nothing. That was more to do with the politics. She's basically a Hindu of origin, and Hindu nationalists in India are quite pro-Israel. And so she went to Israel while she was a minister, and met with various Israeli ministers and senior people, promised to try and get money directed through, from the aid budget to help them. And of course, it was all completely against the guidelines at the time. I mean, so she eventually, it's just like Liam Fox, your opponent that you're going to be meeting in the election. I mean, he got sacked because he took Werity, his mate, to all of these meetings with the Israelis, and they were promising them this, that, and the other, you know. But there's a strong Israel lobby in this country, and they're part of it.
Okay, Anne, what do you make of this appointment or these sorts of conflicts of interest? Just as soon as Boris turns up as Prime Minister, he's appointing people with quite serious conflicts of interest, and she may be there trying to make sure that this company gets a $6 billion defence contract out of it.
But this is where I think it's so damaging for democracy, because what happens is that the ordinary person just looks at these allegations, and not even allegations, but these facts, and they just get completely turned off, because it's like, it's one rule for them, it's another for us. They're all feathering their own nest and they're not even listening to us. And this is where you have a complete breakdown in trust, and you end up with people not voting, not taking part, not believing their votes mean anything, especially not with our first past the post voting system. And this is why it needs to change. If you're in a heavy Tory seat or Labour seat, what difference does your vote actually make? And this is why we really do need to look at our voting system in this country, to make sure that we can actually represent all the interests and not just a few.
And we were given a chance to do this a few years ago. I think it was about 10 years ago, actually, the alternative vote, and people voted against it.
Yeah, I used to be very much against proportional representation, I'll be honest, but I've had a real change on this over the last couple of years, because I've just seen just how disenfranchised so many people are. And I think it's when you look at the number of seats, the number of votes you need in order to win different seats, and how disproportionate it is, and that just can't be right.
Did anyone notice, and it's another part of the issue of trust, and one crucial part of the debate you played, Tony, was a three-way conversation between three Etonians, Boris, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and
Oliver Letwin.
Oliver Letwin. I mean, no wonder ordinary people are brassed off. Our country, irrespective of which side of Brexit you're on, appears to be governed by these people with posh accents and far too much money.
That's nothing new to that, though, is there? I'm not saying it's right, but yeah.
It's always been like that, hasn't it?
I mean, this is the Bullingdon Club as well. Of course, we had a whole load of Oxford people who were mates at Oxford. Nathan Rothschild, one of them, George Osborne, David Cameron, Boris Johnson, all there in part of the Bullingdon Club. It almost seems that there is no real democracy, actually.
Can I just say, on the Bullingdon Club, I went to Oxford, but I couldn't join the Bullingdon Club because I didn't go to Eton College.
I think
you've got to do both.
You have to, don't you not?
No,
have
you have to
be sort of tapped
college
up anyway. You can't join.
No, you can't.
You get told. Right.
No, well, you can't. Exactly. You can't join, but in any case, you've got to be an old Etonian to be in the Bullingdon Club. Yeah, there's lots of people at Oxford who are not old Etonians, but they can't be in it.
And well, even if the Brexit Party, which is very unlikely, romps home and becomes the government when the next general election happens, whenever Jeremy Corbyn allows it to happen, you wouldn't probably be able to change any of this, would you?
See what happened, shall we? Stranger things have happened. I think we're in a different situation now, and it all depends. The events of the next 6 weeks are going to be so interesting, and the polls show that it all depends on whether or not we do come out of the EU by the 31st of October and when the election is called. And it's also...
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.